my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
That we can, and so help us God, we will make America great again.
What's up, guys? Welcome to another episode of the No Gimmicks Podcast. I'm your humble host, as always, Brady Leonard. Hopefully you guys had a fantastic weekend. A great show for you today. I was joined by Jace Yarborough. Jace is a candidate for the Texas State Senate, District 30. And we covered a lot. It was a wide-ranging conversation. We talked about a lot of the issues that affect not just Texas, but all Americans, from the border crisis to school choice and a lot of things. I think you guys will enjoy it. Before we get to Jace, guys, if you haven't already, please follow us on Twitter at No Gimmicks Pod. Please subscribe on iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify, wherever you get your podcast. Make sure to subscribe. If you are an iTunes user, please take a few seconds to leave us a 5-star rating and a good review. We'd really appreciate that. And if you like the show and want to get involved, you can support us monthly over on Patreon, patreon.com/The No Gimmicks Podcast. All right, without further ado, the great Jace Yarborough. All right, guys, we're here with Jace Yarborough. Jace is a candidate for the Senate, Texas Senate District 30. Jace, man, thanks for taking the time today, brother.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on, Brady. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. So I know a lot of Texans do listen to this show, but I'm pretty sure everybody at this point understands that Texas is on the forefront of the fight for the future of the country in a lot of ways, on a lot of very important issues. And we'll get to the issues here in a minute. But real quick, man, in your opinion, what is wrong with the Texas legislature generally? And you know, we've seen a lot of good stuff, but some disappointing news coming out of Austin in recent years as well. And just tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and why do you think you're the right man for the job to help turn it around?
Yeah, sure. Well, so I'm a seventh generation Texan, was raised in a tiny town in a rural part of the state, went down to the University of Texas, studied electrical engineering and government, studied under one of the few kind of conservative professors down there, and then joined the military, was active duty for a bit, separated to go to law school so that my wife and I could move back home and raise our kids near family. So went to law school out at Stanford. I was there during Trump's first election in 2016. My years in law school were 2015 to 2018. So that was a fairly radicalizing experience for me. Massive red pill moment. And then came back and practiced law in with a well-known, you know, Texas firm for a while, but got out last year and went in with a buddy. We do conservative cause litigation. So we fight for pro-life issues, issues of medical freedom and religious liberty in court. Have 5 kids, married to my high school sweetheart. We started a little classical Christian academy 2 years ago to serve folks in our community, and have found myself in the midst of some cultural battles over those years. I, as an active member of the Air Force Reserve, refused the vaccine and almost got kicked out for it. Am also involved in litigation against the Air Force for infringing my First Amendment rights in other ways. I think that anybody who stands up today and presents themselves as a conservative and asks for anyone's vote is going to have to talk about the way they've responded to the cultural onslaught from the left, because nobody is immune from the ideologies that are being pushed on us from any number of directions. So I think the key to ask any candidate and the key element of anybody's background is to say, well, what scar tissue do you have to prove that you believe the principles that you're standing up and saying, hey, these are my convictions. I think Texas, moving to your kind of the first part of your question, what's been wrong with the Texas legislature over the past couple of years. So some of your viewers may be familiar that the Speaker of the Texas House, and the House is usually where a lot of the problems have arisen. The Speaker of the Texas House was elected by Democrats and some liberal squishy Republicans. That really has been the core of why so much good conservative policy has died in the Texas legislature. It's one of the facts that people who move to our state from other more liberal states are shocked to learn. Most people who come here, actually from other states, come here because of what they think Texas is, what they hope it is. And they show up and have a realization that, in fact, our state is not as conservative, is not as bold and aggressive in implementing policies that we conservatives think are good for our communities. And a big problem with that has been the leadership of the Texas House. And March 5th of this year was, I think, an end to that era of compromise with Democrats and giving them significant power and control in that half of the legislature down in Austin.
Right. Right. I do appreciate also going back to what you said a couple minutes ago, that you do have skin in the game. I mean, you have made personal sacrifices, professional sacrifices, certainly. And not to get too personal, but I'm sure you've left in your career quite a bit of money on the table, choosing to represent these conservative causes in court and stuff like that, instead of just going along to get along and working at a reputable firm and taking a paycheck and trying to ignore the world around you. So I do appreciate that. And not a lot of candidates these days are actually willing to make any kind of personal sacrifices. So I definitely think that is a major point in your favor. And there's a lot of states, like you mentioned, with the Texas House. There's a phenomenon in deep red states, or at least perceived deep red states all over the country, that seem to produce a lot of these guys, you know, a lot of these milquetoast, limp-wristed type Republican politicians. Just an example, there's no reason for John Cornyn to be representing the state of Texas in the Senate, just as an example. But, you know, like right now in 2024, this is not a conservative country. You know, a lot of conservative activists try to pretend it is and talk about the silent majority and this and that, but it's just not the case. You know, I think Republicans have only won the popular vote in presidential elections once since Ronald Reagan. You know, and that was Bush in 2004. You know, it's not a conservative country. The average American doesn't really value freedom. We saw that during the pandemic. We saw after the Dobbs decision, which was fantastic, obviously, at the Supreme Court, that all these red states, my home state of Ohio included, all started passing these radical pro-abortion amendments and pieces of legislation. And it's hard. It's hard to get elected as a conservative. Here, just an example, you know, in 2022 here in Ohio, J.D. Vance, who's very right-wing, barely won his Senate seat. He won by less than 3 points, I believe. And then the centrist governor, Mike DeWine, won re-election by 25 points. You know, Vance wouldn't even have won without DeWine at the top of the ticket. So it's hard to win as a cultural conservative, at least above the at the congressional level and above. However, there are a few issues where Republican ideas, even the more radical Republican ideas, are wildly popular. And I think two of them are guns and school choice. Americans hate the Supreme Court via all the polling data, but they loved Bruin, right? During the riots in 2020, anybody who didn't own a gun went out and bought one or two or 10 or, you know, stack them up, fellas. You know, don't tell the libs, but the gun debate is over in this country. Obviously, in Texas, that's not really an issue. Y'all are a constitutional carry state. School choice is a different story. You know, for some reason, the Texas legislature can't seem to get it done. It's confusing a lot of conservatives all over the country. You know, they're looking up, why? You know, Arizona passed it, West Virginia, all the, you know, Georgia, Florida, and Texas can't get it done.
Yeah.
When swing states are passing universal school choice, like Arizona, a true swing state, passed school choice under a Republican governor. Republicans then ran some bad candidates, lost the whole state. The whole state's run by far-left Democrats. And the Democrats can't get rid of school choice because it's so popular, not just among what people would call traditional Republican demographics. I mean, school choice polls at 80% among Black Americans, 80% among Hispanic Americans, like 75 or 80% among registered Democrats. You know, it's popular everywhere. So why hasn't Texas gotten this done yet? And what's your plan to help make it happen?
Yeah, so There are a couple of reasons for that. The first one is the leadership dynamic that we just talked about with regard to the Texas House. So the governor, Governor Abbott, obviously came out very forcefully in favor of school choice over the past session and called a number of special sessions after that to try to get the ball over the finish line. Ultimately, it was unsuccessful. The Senate several times passed a school choice bill. Now, I'll qualify that by saying that the version of the bill that almost got over the finish line, the last one that was killed in the fourth special session this last term, would have only helped a small sliver of students in Texas. I think somebody did the math and it was something like the only students who would have benefited from that school choice bill would have been the number of students that were in like Arlington ISD or something like that.
Wow. Yeah.
And so it was a modest proposal. It included a ton of extra dollars to ISDs who would lose students, and yet it couldn't get over the finish line. So part of that was because of the left of center leadership of the Texas House, which is changing. But another dynamic I think that might be unique to Texas is the role that ISDs plays in some of our rural communities. So rural Republicans, let me be clear, rural Republicans favor school choice bills. They do, as a majority in Texas. But a lot of the leadership of those ISDs in rural school districts are very concerned, and they're concerned for a couple of reasons. So the first one is usually that an ISD in a rural community tends to be the biggest employer. So it touches on a number of families and people whose convictions would otherwise align with the conservative convictions of the right wing of the Republican Party. The second reason is that those folks see the issues with ISDs in other places, and they think, oh, you know, CRT or DEI or these radical ideologies would never be pushed in my ISD, right? Because I know sweet Mrs. Smith, who teaches second grade, or we go to church with my son's sophomore English teacher, and she would never teach those ideologies. And then the third thing is, you know, it's Friday Night Lights, right? This is, these ISDs are the pride and joy of local communities. And look, I lived that, and I was appreciative of it. I went to high school, I went to public school in a rural community out in West Texas. I actually played football with Colt McCoy, the winningest quarterback in UT football history. And we both went to the tiny school together, graduated together, and had a very successful run as a high school team.
I'd imagine.
As you can imagine, with a quarterback of that quality, and some other great guys who we played with. And so I understand, and it was a big part of my formation as a young man to represent my community, to do it well, to work at something and to do it with excellence, and also to win and lose nobly as a representative of that community. That was a good thing. So I don't have anything against Friday Night Lights in that sense, but it is not the ultimate end of the education of our children. And even though these folks are convinced that CRT and DEI would never sort of happen in their backyard, I think they're just fundamentally wrong about that. Because even if the ideologies that we see as explicitly inimical to a just, free, and good society and the formation of our kids aren't being pushed in those schools, the underlying philosophy that's being pushed down to these rural communities from the bureaucrats in Austin who set the curriculum and the certification requirements are very much at odds with the values of Texas families, even if it's not obvious to a second grade teacher who also happens to teach Sunday school, for example. And so those are some of the dynamics at play here in Texas. That's a little bit of the history. I do think it's changing. And I certainly want to be somebody who is advocating very strongly for parental empowerment education. I will say that when I talk about this on the campaign trail, you know, I talk about school choice as first and foremost giving parents not just the legal ability, but also the financial ability to choose the education they think is right for their kids. But we can't stop there, because if what has happened across the country when school choice has been implemented happens here in Texas, a majority of Texas parents are still going to put their kids in what we today call public schools.
Right.
So my children are going to grow up and they're going to build community. They're going to get married to. They're going to, you know, serve with people who have been formed in the Texas public school system. And we have to do something about that. And transparency, I think, is probably a first step in that direction. But when I talk about parental empowerment education, I talk not only just about school choice, but also, okay, what are we going to do with the fact that the largest player in this space, at least for this foreseeable future, even if we have a wildly successful school choice program, is still going to be our public schools, which right now are absolutely at odds with the values of the majority of Texans and their families.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And obviously, iron sharpens iron, too. Competition would make those public schools, or what we now call public schools, a lot better in the long run anyway. You know, more competition,
yes,
rising tide lifts all ships. You know, I'm sympathetic to the argument, you know, like I go to church with, you know, my kid's teacher and, you know, they would never do this. And we've just seen that mentality fail at this point, you know, and obviously I believe we should have had universal school choice when you and I were growing up, because it's the moral thing to do. Mm-hmm. If you're a politician, you know, sure. I think it is an act of evil to force parents to send their children to a failing school. It doesn't matter if they're pushing trans propaganda or not. I mean, it's you know, forcing people to do things they don't want to do at gunpoint, I think, is immoral. But obviously, in the 90s and early 2000s when I was in school, they weren't trying to trans the kids. There wasn't porn in school libraries. There wasn't all this stuff, or at least nobody noticed if there were. But unfortunately, our hands have been forced. I mean, this is about nullifying the left, you know, and then those two issues. I'm not trying to claim I'm some kind of, you know, gatekeeper for the Republican Party or anything. But when it comes to school choice and when it comes to guns, I think those are those issues, you know, Republicans that fold, that get weak on one of those two issues or both need to be shown the door, because it's about giving parents the ability to protect their families in the way they seem fit. And we just can't fail our children now. You know, the left has completely taken over education. We've mentioned all the, you know, some, and states have started to push back. Florida in massive ways have pushed back against this. But our hands have been forced. You know, it's unlikely that, you know, whether Trump wins or loses, it doesn't really matter. I doubt Republicans are going to elect a Ron Paul who would eliminate the Department of Education tomorrow. You know what I mean? Like, that's not going to happen. We're not going to get radical change, even with conservative leadership in Washington. So it is about just giving parents the ability to just nullify the predations of the left. You want trans activists teaching kids? Well, we don't need your school anyway. Who cares? You want the cops to be pro-criminal, pro-criminality? They're not going to arrest, you know, whatever, people that assault people on the subway. Well, who cares? If you're carrying a peacemaker, then your life's going to be a lot more peaceful anyway. So it's about nullifying the, you know, if parents can arm themselves, if they can take, you know, state money to send their kids to whatever school they want, schools that fit their values, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't really matter what's happening at the Department of Education. It doesn't really matter even what's happening in Austin, right? Let alone Washington, if parents have the God-given right to raise their kids how they see fit.
Yeah. Yes. Well, if a majority of parents will do that, then yes. I mean, we need a critical mass. This is sort of the phrase that I say. We need at least a critical mass of children who've been well-formed, who can lead the rest of the folks. Because there are, just frankly, and I've seen this, just trying to help parents whose children are in the public school system and have been very much abused by it, giving them, hey, this is the path out. This is the way you can push back against this. And unfortunately, so many parents are timid. And, you know, they get resolution of a particular issue. And you know, some of these instances that I have in mind, won't necessarily go into details, but I mean, they involve physical harm being done to their children by other kids in the school.
Yeah.
And then the kids who have been hurt are then punished.
Yeah.
It just mind-blowing circumstances. And these parents, you know, I connect them with resources. I've already, you know, I've become somebody that on the campaign trail, people sort of know where I stand on this issue. And so reach out to me, I'll connect them with resources to help them through the immediate crisis. And when do they get to the other side? The response is, well, okay, everything's resolved now. And what I want to say is, no, I mean, the whole system is operating to push your child in this particular direction. I mean, think about the psychological formation that happens when a child goes through circumstances like this.
Yeah.
Is somebody who, you know, pushes back even to the smallest degree and then is punished for it by the apparatus and has to go through, you know, whatever the procedural mechanisms are to address this and finally get some relief or at least avoid punishment on the other end. Forget about justice for the people who came after the young man or woman who had the gall to stand up for something that, you know, ideologies that didn't toe the party line or behavior that didn't comport with the, you know, sort of, correct approach to these racial differences that we see, right? If you're a particular color, you have to respond to people of another color in a certain way, intense situations, right? So, parents, even in those circumstances, though, I found they don't want to go all the way, and they're nervous or distracted. And so I do think that addressing what's going on in public schools is going to be really important. And I will say also, just because some of the more radical and in-your-face ideologies aren't being pushed in a public school, really, I do think that there is a fundamental misconception at the heart of American education. I've seen this. I saw it even in my own education. And I had a good public school experience. My teachers were with me in church on Sundays. My mom was a substitute teacher. She was up there pretty much every day. We still got corporal punishment when we stepped out of line and violated, you know, the codes of conduct. But even there, I could see how, if it wasn't explicit, there was a core idea that was really forming me and my psyche and my character in a way that I think is dangerous. And I'll give you an example. I remember being in second grade and we went through these fact versus opinion exercises. I don't know if you have this version wherever you grew up in Maryland or elsewhere, but you know, the idea is you give little Johnny a statement and his job is to classify it as either a fact or an opinion. And I'm sure this was teaching to some standardized test that we were all going to take at the end of the year, but
Right.
Right. You give little Johnny a fact and it's, you know, something innocuous like, you know, water boils at 212 degrees Fahrenheit at sea level. Is that a fact or an opinion? Oh, that's a fact. Good job. Right. And the next statement is something like chocolate ice cream is good. Is that a fact or an opinion? Oh, that's an opinion. Right. Great job, little Johnny. And what are you teaching him to do? You're teaching him to find a value judgment in a statement. And if it is, if it's non-quantifiable, if you can't use the scientific method to evaluate or determine whether this statement is true or false, then it must be an opinion. And again, all the examples in elementary school are innocuous. And they're about water boiling or the color of grass or
right.
wind speeds or something like that. And then you get to college and they start to drop in the content. Right. So they'll say something like premarital sex is good. Well, that's just an opinion. You already have this relativistic scientistic formation that allows those at university to radicalize these kids almost overnight. Right. And
right.
these things are being taught by sweet second grade teachers who also teach Sunday school. And I keep coming back to that point. But this is what's going. This is the kind of curriculum that's being offered to our students. And it runs deep, very deep. And you have to have a PhD in philosophy at some points to see what's going on. But
yeah.
the folks that control that curriculum, they're very much dedicated to clandestinely separating children from their parents and their values. Right?
Yes.
Conservative parents and their values. They think that it is their moral obligation to do this. This is what drives them. We have to save these kids from their backward parents.
Yeah.
And until you realize that, you know, you're not really in the game, in my opinion, in the education space.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, one way I'd encourage you, you mentioned reaching the need to reach critical mass. The day the Universal School Choice Program was launched in Arizona, so many tens of thousands of parents were signing up for the program at the same time that they crashed the government website.
So it can't
on some of these issues. I mean, sometimes it takes generations. Sometimes it happens real quick, you know. So
mm-hmm.
it, especially when it comes to children, I think we could see a lot of parents leaving timidity behind where it belongs and actually standing up for their children. At least I hope and pray that that's the case.
Yes.
Despite the fact that your district is in North Texas, I have to imagine that given the crisis on the southern border, the number one issue you're hearing from voters is border security. We've never seen illegals invading the country in numbers like this before. It's like, what, 4 million since Joe Biden took office, something like that. We've all at this point seen, if you're living under a rock, Google it. But I think everybody in this audience has seen by now the video last week of several hundred military-aged
yes.
males assaulting National Guardsmen. The Biden regime
yes.
sued Texas to try to prevent Governor Abbott from securing the border. What are people
yep.
in Texas 30 saying about the border crisis?
Yeah, it's the number one issue by an order of magnitude, and that
yeah.
easily.
Yeah.
And what's going on down there, you know, it affects us. We've got a couple of major thoroughfares that come up through Senate District 30 and I-35 and Highway 75, both of which have become hot rails of traffic for humans, for smuggling, for fentanyl and other substances. A lot of our rural, I've got about 80% of my district is rural by land mass. And a lot of those counties, I mean, this is, the way you could sometimes describe it is this is an unfunded mandate that is hitting our rural communities hardest.
Yeah.
Because what happens is law enforcement is required to deal with the consequences, not just of criminal activity, but also of humanitarian crisis, right? I mean, there was a I recently published about this in the Blaze, but there's a sheriff in one of my counties, rural county. His deputies pulled over a car, had four adults in it. Three of them were Romanian, Eastern European. One of them was a Hispanic woman, and they had three Hispanic children in the car. None of them spoke English. And it was clear to the deputies this was an instance of human trafficking, right? But there's nothing they could do about it because no apparent crime had been broken. They
right.
couldn't separate these kids from their supposed guardians. And that's that is all too often – that's a common experience now for folks in my district. And, I mean, these people, you know, they've lived in towns of 200, 300, 400 people their entire lives, and now they're seeing things that are harrowing and have international – implications and ties. And so, yes, it's a huge issue, but also because whether we're fitting the bill for healthcare through ER or as we've been required to by the courts, you know, educating these children in our public schools, it's a massive, massive burden on everyone. And these folks aren't coming here because they love our country. Right? These people are coming here because this is a place to take. They right. come, they take, and when everything is has basically gone to hell, then okay, now it's time to move on. Right? We're not we have no control over what's going on our border. And to your point about the Biden administration, you know, there's never been a time in our nation's history where the dynamic, as you rightly describe it, has happened, which is we push back even in a tiny way against those who are trying to come into our state without our permission. And the federal government's Department of Justice sues us on behalf of those invaders. Right. That is stark. And I think and I hope, and this is something that I do talk about, it's a little bit more abstract, but we've got to get over this idea that just because the Supreme Court says something, that means it's the rule for all places and all times moving forward. That has not been the American approach to our constitutional regime for the majority of our history. It's a later 20th century conceit. And, you know, I point to Lincoln's position on the Dred Scott decision for guidance for those statesmen, including our governor, who have an obligation to stand up under their constitutional duties as they understand them. The primary one being the protection of the communities and the people under his jurisdiction. If you're not ready to push back against a federal government who is mortgaging the future of our children to encourage those who do not have permission to be here to come, and then seeding them throughout the country and our state, then I honestly don't know what business you have being in office. If that's not your primary duty, then under our constitutional regime, then I don't know what duty you have. And so I also try to emphasize that point and to say this is a time for serious statesmanship. It's a time for those who have thought critically about the situation we're in and are formed in the constitutional history of our state and our country, and who can stand up and say, you know, and encourage the governor and say, look, sir, you, by standing up for us and pushing back against the federal government, you know, you're required to honor the Supreme Court's decisions, but only as to the parties and issues in front of it. And your obligation otherwise is to fulfill your constitutional duties as you understand them. And that includes protecting us and our families from those who are trying to come forcefully without our permission, or even not forcefully without our permission. So it's a huge issue. It's an issue that requires, again, statesmanship of the highest order. Sometimes I wonder whether we are a people capable of producing the kind of men that are going to be required to face these issues and lead and follow through them to get to the other side and to find again some kind of ordered liberty in our regime. But yeah, it's a huge issue.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Have you spoken to any law enforcement who've been down on the border? I mean, these videos coming out are I mean, we've been seeing them obviously for years now. But it is surreal seeing state troopers, seeing border control, seeing the National Guard, powerless. You know, their mandate is to essentially do nothing and to let these people yeah. flow over the border. So it is, I can't imagine what these men and women in law enforcement are thinking, being down there unable, legally speaking, to do their jobs. You know, it's a surreal scene. It doesn't seem like something coming out of the United States. It seems like, you know, some movie about a far, far off land, right? a long time ago or something. It is a surreal scene seeing these men and women just sit on their hands. Because they have to. Have you spoken to law enforcement who've been down there from your district?
Yeah. So this is not the way that a country that's serious about its future behaves. This is the way that a country who is attempting to commit suicide behaves, right? I mean, I've said this before, and other people have said it, right? The late Roman, the late Republic aesthetic that we have is undeniable.
Yeah.
And my brother was a highway patrolman, a DPS trooper. When Operation Lone Star kicked up almost 3 years, I guess it's been over 3 years ago now. He was in San Angelo, Texas, is where his home station was. He's out in the western part of the state. 2 weeks out of every month, he was sent down to the border as part of Operation Lone Star. And he was 2 weeks back in home station. One of those weeks at home, he was on nights. You put all that together, he was seeing his four children, whom he and his wife had recently adopted out of the Texas foster care system. He was seeing them basically 2 to 3 days a month.
Oh, wow.
It was absolutely unsustainable. Absolutely unsustainable. And he asked the question, how long are we going to have to do this? And the response was, well, probably till we get a new president.
Okay.
And so
you said he's a state trooper?
Yeah, highway patrolman. So that's the folks down at the border are one part National Guard, one part state trooper, and then other states have sent some of their guardsmen down to help as well. Those are kind of the main,
gotcha.
In terms of what the state itself is providing, you know, over and above federal forces or those who are regularly stationed down there. Operation Lone Star is about sending state troopers, gotcha. Primarily about sending state troopers down to the border. So he was doing that, and he got out. He got out because of the strain it was putting on his family. But his biggest point of frustration was while he was down there, his job was to sit in his patrol car and wait until illegals approached him. He could not go after them.
You got to be kidding me.
He had to wait till they approached him. And when they approached him, he was supposed to document what, you know, who they were, what the interaction was. And then he was to drop them off at the local gas station, drop them off at the local Stripes. That's what his job was. And he thought, I'm sacrificing so much to do this for my family, for my state. And I don't actually even get to, protect anyone or anything. Wow. Why am I doing this?
Yeah.
So he got out. And when I say that much of what we do is about optics, it's things like that, right?
Yeah.
Now, Operation Lone Star has made it more uncomfortable vis-a-vis other ports of entry to get into the United States. And so I understand that in terms of diverting the flow of illegals, Operation Lone Star has had some effect. And I'm not an expert in all the particulars here. And so I don't want to say that it has been, I'm not here to say that it's been worthless by any stretch of the imagination. But if we're serious about enforcing our border, if we're serious about being able to have an immigration policy that says which ones and how many, then we've got to start expatriating people, sending them back,
yeah.
Not dropping off at the gas station, not turning them over to the federal authorities who will then just seed them throughout the rest of the country. We have to start sending them back home as part of our border enforcement.
Yeah, it's the only way. It's the only option. Real quick before I let you go, Jace, one issue that is important to me and many in the audience, even though it rarely makes headlines, might not even be something that you're aware of, to be honest, and that is Defend the Guard legislation. State legislators in several states have introduced legislation in recent years saying that D.C. Can't send their National Guardsmen into foreign wars without a congressional declaration of war that the Constitution requires.
Yes.
The goal of this, obviously, is that even if a handful of states, certainly a large, highly populated state like Texas, would pass legislation like this, it would severely hamper Washington's ability to involve us in unnecessary wars. And a little bird told me, who's involved in this project, did tell me that some folks are trying to get this on the docket in Texas next year. So
yes, that's correct.
Would this legislation be something that you would support?
Absolutely. Yeah. If your priorities are such that you are wringing your hands over what's going on in Ukraine while turning a blind eye to what's going on at the border, then we've lost our way. We've lost ourselves. And so I absolutely would support that kind of legislation, agree with it both in terms of philosophy and approach and implementation. The characteristic, I think, for the foreign policy that should control whatever you want to call it, if it's a new Republican Party or the new right, it should be a posture of humility, which says we have things that are deeply, deeply wrong on the home front. And before we can expend any kind of serious resources elsewhere, we've got to get those things squared away. We are absolutely in that kind of situation right now. And so, absolutely would be something I support, something I do support. And yes, you're right. There is an effort to get that listed actually as a legislative priority for the Republican Party. And we just had our state conventions last weekend, which is sort of step number two in ultimately getting those propositions and proposals up to the state convention. That'll happen at the end of May. And out of that will come the Republican Party's priorities, legislative priorities for the upcoming session. And I've committed to, one of the problems we've had here as a Republican Party is that we can't get our, we had 8 legislative priorities last session. I think 1.5 of them were ultimately passed. And that's a huge problem, right?
Yeah.
The Republican Party in Texas is experiencing grassroots conservatives are becoming much more influential in the party. They're passing legislative priorities, and the politicians we send down to Austin don't champion those priorities significantly enough. So you're right about on all counts, and yes, I do support that.
That's great news. That's great news. And a lot of the, I was excited to have you on today too, because, and not to sound like a pessimist or anything, there's plenty of other pundits that are more pessimistic than me, but the name of the game is nullification moving forward. You know, it's just I don't really have that much hope for Washington, D.C., regardless of who's in power. Republicans keep changing the Speaker of the House, and they're not happy with any of them. They all turn out to suck. You know what I mean? It's like, it's whatever. You know, we got a Republican President Trump, and then he hands the full authority of the United States federal government to Anthony Fauci, and they destroy the global economy. You know, so it's just like it seems like no matter what we do, we can't win at a federal level. But that is just not the case when you're talking about state legislatures. State legislatures, like, look, I understand. We all know where the House of Representatives' bread is buttered. You know, they're never going to stop sending money to Ukraine, sending money to the Middle Eastern wars. Republican, Democratic presidents, they're not gonna stop. I mean, they're bought and paid for. It is what it is. States can step up and do something about it. You know what I mean? Like the federal education system is completely broken. Who cares? The states can do something about it. They don't want to secure the border. Okay, fine. Don't secure New Mexico. You guys can secure it in Texas. You know, the anti-gun stuff coming out of the Biden regime, state legislatures can have that covered, can give their constituents the ability to protect themselves. I think this next era of American politics, and it sucks. I hate saying that. I'm not too optimistic that we're going to get anything done federally, but that does not mean that in the states, especially the red states, can't free their people and protect their citizens and do the right things on the state level. I think we're going to see a lot of that. A lot of states, hopefully Texas is chief among them. I think what we are going to see a lot of states nullifying a lot of the predations of the federal government, specifically the left, in the next 5-10 years, you know? And so, if you live in a blue state, maybe consider, you know, there's hey, there's no state income tax in Texas. You know, we might want to consider moving. Right. But I do think there is a lot of hope. While I don't see hope for the federal government in the near term, I view the states completely the opposite. And I think we need a lot more bold leaders on the right, like yourself, who are willing to get in there and not be timid, like we were talking about earlier, not be afraid and actually stand up for their constituents.
Yeah, I agree with that, Brady. And I would encourage your listeners, find, recruit, and fund those candidates in your states that see this problem and see the solution to it as bold, competent, and creative leadership at the state level. Right? I mean, one of the things that I do on my day job, I'm a litigator, I'm a lawyer. My law partner and I, we bring cases that use some of the most recently passed pro-life legislation, for example, here in Texas, to fight sort of at the next line for pro-life issues. And I don't necessarily need to go into the details on that. Probably would make some people's eyes glaze over. But the point is that you can do a lot at the state level to push back, as you said, against what the federal government's doing. But you have to have people that are serious about it, who see the project for what it is, and have the formation and competence to execute. Because the last thing you want, right, is to set bad precedent, people that go in and all they know how to do is throw cocktails and burn bridges, right? Right. And so I hope that, and I've seen this as I've been on the campaign trail and just some people have reached out to me. I think people who are genuinely motivated by public service, who don't just want to be the next congressman from some random district in Western California, but who really, you know, they recognize that, you know, the Gauls are at the gates, right? I mean, we are in a time of serious crisis, and there's real power to be leveraged for the good of our communities and our neighbors in offices that were, you know, unfortunately for a time, seen as kind of less than by a lot of ambitious people and politicians. Right. So anyway, I would just encourage your listeners, find the candidates who are able and willing to serve at the state level, recruit them, fund them, because here in Texas, this cycle, and I'm the beneficiary of this, grassroots conservatives have figured out how to organize on the ground. Yeah. And the establishment is, you know, there is no amount of money that can make up for committed grassroots supporters.
Yeah.
There isn't, right? And that has been a huge disadvantage for us. And at least at the state level, we can neutralize those forces that want to push us for financial reasons, want to push us toward more war in the Middle East, more funding for Ukraine. So, I just encourage them again, find and fund those candidates and support them, and make it a part of just your regular kind of monthly financial habits, right? So one of the things about incumbency is they're raising money and support throughout their time in office. So as soon as one election cycle ends, for us as grassroots conservatives, for those races that we lost, the next cycle should immediately begin. We 100%. Should immediately begin funding and recruiting and funding those candidates that are going to take on establishment candidates who have sold us out.
Yeah.
And you know, ultimately the goal is for people who run as conservatives to know they better behave that way when they get down to Austin or to Baltimore or Annapolis or DC or wherever it is that they've said they're going to go and then behave like it and govern like it.
Yeah,
that's ultimately what we want.
Absolutely. And if you can't find a candidate support, maybe try looking in the mirror. You know, we definitely need more,
yes,
more good men and women to step up. And, you know, I'd even go a step further. I agree with everything you said, obviously. It's funny when you have serious people in state legislatures who are bold and do, you know, make a full throated case for bold conservative legislation. You can turn these establishment, entrenched, milquetoast establishment politicians into conservative firebrands pretty quick because it turns out a lot of these ideas are very popular. In my home state of Ohio, as an example, Mike DeWine's terrible. He's terrible.
Yeah.
He's like a left-of-center Republican. He's awful. He signed constitutional carry into law. You know, he signed universal school choice into law. He signed the heartbeat bill into law. Unfortunately, we lost the heartbeat bill because voters passed a constitutional amendment that entrenched taxpayer-funded abortion into law forever, which is, that's our own problem here in Ohio. But the point is, Mike DeWine is no conservative firebrand, okay? He's not.
Yep.
He's no libertarian on guns or anything else. But these things are very popular. School choice is extremely popular. Constitutional carry is very popular. You can work with these rhinos. You can work with these establishment types if you have the boldness to actually win over the public, get them on your side, and make it very clear that they will lose their job and their reputation if they don't go along with it.
Yep. No, I absolutely agree with that. And the way I think about any body, whether it's a legislative body or the group of constituents in a jurisdiction, you're always going to have about 20%. If you can turn them, you can turn the rest.
Yes.
Right. And when I say turn the rest, I don't mean turn the other 80%. I mean, you can turn that other 35%, 40% that is, you know, they lack the courage of their convictions or they're not really convinced of the positions they hold. And so, yes, state legislatures are a great place for those who have thought about the issues and have the experience to advocate effectively for them, to build coalitions that are significant and to inspire other people, right? I mean, my campaign is kind of an example of this. There are a lot of good people who have put their reputations on the line to support our campaign. But if you look at the details, all of those people that support me are sort of the county GOP chairman level and down.
Yeah.
Anybody who's been elected to office sort of at the state house level or above is endorsing my opponent.
Right.
And supporting my opponent. And the reason for that is the powers that be down in Austin want him and not me.
Yeah.
And there's a reason I think that they want him and not me. And it goes to this idea that we're talking about now, which is, you know, I have some ideas that I think the majority of Texans agree with, but that would make those folks down there pretty uncomfortable to have to deal with.
So, absolutely.
Yes.
Well, I hope you make those folks real uncomfortable real soon, my brother. You have my endorsement. I wish you nothing but the best. I encourage everybody to check out the campaign website, get involved if you're in the area, write a check if you can afford it. Where can everybody get in touch?
Yeah, that's Jace for Texas. So Ace with a J, F-O-R, and then Texas spelled out, T-E-X-A-S, jaceforTexas.com. I'd be grateful for folks to sign up to receive our emails. And if you can chip in $25, that'd be awesome. We'd really appreciate it.
Everybody sign up for the email list. Everybody follow Jace on Twitter. He's great. That's all I got for today. I'm Brady Leonard. I'll be back on Wednesday. No gimmicks.